According to the clock on the wall,
it's time for us to begin.
We're studying in the book of Psalms, just getting started in our study. We talked about kinds of Psalms, and I think it's important for us to keep this in mind. We may come across this a number of times. There are individual and communal lament Psalms, or Psalms of prayer for the deliverance of God. And we're going to see various occasions for that. We're going to see the occasion. And keep in mind, when we study the Psalms, we're studying a book that was written over a period of probably more conservative estimates, about 600 years. Some of the more extensive estimates would be up to 1,000 years. So we've got Psalms that deal with the period of time of Moses leading the children of Israel up through the wilderness. And then we've got Psalms that reach all the way to the period of the restoration that is beyond the period of Babylonian captivity. So you put your pencil to that and do the math, and you've got a lot of years involved in the Psalms. We've got a lot of different authors. And so the Psalms are the revelation of these men, inspired of God, to help us to understand the feelings that they had. Now, some of them, like we said, are expressed in prayer, desire for deliverance. Now, whether that be deliverance from the Babylonian captivity, as we'll note, or whether that be deliverance from the wilderness, as we will note, or deliverance from enemies, as we will note, you'll see that David expressed the Psalms about the persecution of Saul, how that he sought his life, and then his son Absalom, and the wars that took place there. So, Psalms of deliverance, and there's a lot of them. Royal Psalms that talk about the king, and in particular, our king, the king of the kingdom, that is Jesus the Christ, and there are many of those. There are wisdom Psalms. Psalm 1 becomes a classic illustration of that. Psalm 37, if you're making notes of these things. And then Psalm 119, as it emphasizes the importance of God's Word in relation to making wise choices. And then there are the imprecatory Psalms that we've mentioned from time to time. And I think sometimes this becomes a hang-up point in our minds, because when we talk about imprecatory Psalms, they are Psalms that are presented in the form somewhat of a prayer, expressing the person's desire for God to take vengeance and to pronounce judgment upon those who are enemies. And you'll see some examples of that as we have identified in the 7th Psalm and the 40th Psalm and so forth. So there are several of those. And comments relative to that we'll hold off on until we get to that. We've talked about the Messianic Psalms. Time permitting, I want to talk more about some specific application of that in our study perhaps this morning. There are different types of Messianic Psalms. But we want to note the use of the Psalms by the Jews. Keep in mind that there are about 116 specifically quoted in the New Testament, more than that that are alluded to. And so the Jews certainly had a use for them, and many of the Psalms were prophecies concerning even the Gentiles. So these were quoted not only to Jews, but also to Gentiles. And then that brings us to the point that we were discussing last time. What do we do with the Psalms? Are there any benefits to us from studying the Psalms? And as we mentioned a moment ago, and I think last week, the Psalms express emotion. Now, there are all kinds of emotions. There is the emotion of praise and thanksgiving, and there is the emotion of despair. The question of deliverance, as we talked about. And then there is the expectations of God's response, and then our response to God. And so there are many emotions that are expressed in the Psalm. But what can we do with that? We know, and frequently when we study any Old Testament book, we reference Romans chapter 15, verse 3 and 4.
to note that the things that were written aforetime were written for our learning. So yes, there is benefit and purpose for us to study from the Psalms. In recognition of that, we've noted that some of the Psalms help us to understand the great power and majesty of God, help us to understand God's providence, His working in the field of natural law, the tenderness of God, we talked about that last week, the justice of God, and then our proper response to God. Now, some of these things is where I want to begin in our study this morning. And to do that, let me get on the right page here in my notes. Turn with me to Psalms 19. Psalms 19. I have on the board some specific verses, verses 12 through 14, but I want to notice earlier, in fact, to begin in verse 1 of Psalms 19. You'll recognize this. It says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth His handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language, their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them hath He set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoiceth as a strong man to run his course. His going forth is from the ends of the heavens, and his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof." Now notice in those verses, he's specifically describing the grandeur of God in His creation. The heavens declare the glory of God. How many of you get up and see the sunrise? Some of you get up before the sunrise, but you see the sun come up. Do you ever think of it as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber? The beginning of a new day. Now, when you look at the rising of the sun, there's no voice expressing anything. But what you see is the declaration of the glory of God. God put it that way. Now, in verses 1 through 6, we see the grandeur of God in His creation. Now, why would that be so important? You'll notice that the heading, and these headings are somewhat important to us. The heading on this particular psalm is for the chief musician, a psalm of David. Now, when we come down to the conclusion of this psalm, I want you to note some things against the backdrop of David's life. We mentioned a few moments ago that King Saul sought to kill David. Without going back and reading the Old Testament history, if you want to, it's in 1 Samuel 15 and 1 Chronicles chapter 10, where you can read about the conflict between Saul and David and how that on more than one occasion Saul sought to kill him. And then we've got the conflict with his son Absalom, how that Absalom sought to kill him. Now, when you're thinking of difficult times, perhaps it's hard to look at the sunrise and be reminded of the glory of God. But there's not any difficult time that should supersede what you see every morning when you get up and see the sunrise. Well, that declares the glory of God. Now, why is that so important? Look, if you will, now beginning in this section of Psalm 19, verse 7. Now, we're not doing a detailed study of this psalm. We'll perhaps come back later to do that. But to read it and to have an impression of what it's about is important to us. Verse 7. "The law of Jehovah is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of Jehovah is sure, making wise the simple." Sound familiar? We sing that. It's called Psalm 119 in our songbook. You'll note in verse 8, "The precepts of Jehovah are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of Jehovah is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of Jehovah is clean. The ordinances of Jehovah are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the droppings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is thy servant warned. In keeping them, there is great reward." Now let's pause right there for just a moment. What have we seen in this chapter? We've seen the glory of God in His creation. We have seen the beauty of the law of the Lord. Now, in the remainder of this chapter, I would suggest to you, what we see is our response to that. What do you do with that? You look at the heavens and they declare the glory of God. You look at His law and you see that it's perfect and it'll make you perfect. All right, so I'll just forget all that and go about my day and live every day of my life ever how I want to. Is that what we do? We just do what we want to. It doesn't make any difference what God has done. Doesn't make any difference what He says. No, look at what David says. It says, "Who can discern his errors? Clear thou me from hidden faults. Keep back thy servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then shall I be upright, and I shall be clear from great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Jehovah, my rock and my redeemer." Randy?
It seems the whole psalm up until 13 is a list of truths. Truths about nature, truths about the Word of God. And 13 and 14 is a prayer in the acknowledgement that God has revealed Himself in two ways. Through nature and through His Word. And by acknowledging Himself and realizing that He is who He is, the Creator of all things, including us, then we acknowledge Him by worshiping Him and praying to Him in this way.
We respond. And I think that's the thing that we need to take home with us this morning. If we forget who God is, then our response is essentially to God is nothing. It's rebellion. Do as I please. It doesn't make me any difference what you've done. Doesn't make me any difference what you've said. Now, if we want to pursue that course, here we are. David says, "Clear thou me from hidden faults." Question. You ever do something that was wrong? You didn't realize at the time that you did it that it was wrong. Case in point. We read in 1 Timothy chapter 1. Beginning actually about verse 12, Paul talks about how that before he learned any better, he was a blasphemer. He was injurious. He held the garments, you recall, of those who stoned Stephen. This is what I did. But he said, I did it in ignorance. You read in Acts chapter 3, verse 19, I believe it is, or is it verse 17, where the apostle Peter accuses the rulers of the Jews of crucifying the Lord, but they did it in ignorance. They didn't know. And when it was pointed out to them in verse 36 of Acts chapter 2, the text tells us, verse 37, when they heard this, they were pricked in their heart and said, what shall we do? They didn't know. They did this in ignorance. And so now they've learned better. What do we do? I would suggest to you that as David asked, as you've expressed it, Randy, in a prayer, keep back thy servant from presumptuous sins. Now, you do some things in ignorance. You do some things in presumption. They're not the same. When you presume, you're doing something wrong and you know better. Now let that hit bottom. You know better. Presumptuous sins. Case in point. Nadab and Abihu. We always use Nadab a lot. Use Nadab and Abihu to illustrate men that acted without authority. They offered a strange fire unto the Lord. We don't know where they got it from, but they did not get it from the coals of the altar. Would it be fair to say that they presumed that it really didn't make any difference, that the fire that they used would be just as good as the one from the coals of the altar? Did they know better? They were the sons of Aaron. They should have been taught better. They knew better, but they presumed that this would be just as good. Case in point, when you consider King Saul. When King Saul presumed, here's Samuel over here saying, well, you know, you wait there at Gilgal. When I get there, we'll offer sacrifice. Or I will. And King Saul's explanation when Samuel came, he'd already done it. And Samuel pointed out what a foolish thing he had done. King Saul was a man that was selected to be king by God, but he wasn't a priest.
The implications are overwhelming that Samuel was. He was authorized to do it. Saul was not. And consequently, we find that after chapter 15 of 1 Samuel, that was in chapter 13, in 1 Samuel chapter 15, we know that King Saul was instructed to go and smite Amalek and destroy all that he had, but he didn't do that. He brought back the best of the Amalekites, and his intent was, according to his words, was to offer these as a sacrifice unto the Lord. I would suggest that he knew better. God said, utterly destroy them. Man, woman, ox, sheep, camel, ass. You destroy everything they got. But he presumed that what his idea was just as good as what God said. No, that won't work. David's thought here is, keep me from presumptuous sins. So whether or not you sin because you didn't know it was wrong, or swing the pendulum the other way and you commit sin just because you think what you're doing is just as good as what God said, neither one of those work. Neither one of those work. And so in light of God is great, He is good, look at what He's created, His law is right, it is good, and it'll make you right and good. So help me to be informed so I won't make ignorant decisions. And help me to act consistently with what I know. Now, is that fair? Now, what we see in that is the response. Response to God. Let's look at another one. Turn, if you will, to Psalm 63. Psalm 63. In Psalm 63, beginning at verse 1. There the text tells us, O God, Thou art my God. Earnestly will I seek Thee. My soul thirsteth for Thee. My flesh longeth for Thee in a dry and weary land where no water is. Let's pause. Notice the introduction. The words, the heading. A Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. You remember when Absalom, and even when King Saul, for that matter, was trying to kill David? David was on the run. And in particular, you'll notice, when Absalom was trying to kill him, David fled the city of Jerusalem and he went to the other side of the Jordan, into the wilderness. His heart was heavy because his own son was trying to kill him. And he said, earnestly will I seek Thee. My soul thirsteth for Thee. My flesh longeth for Thee in a dry and weary land where no water is. Any of you ever been out to Jawbone Canyon? Never been there? Well, you ought to go out there. James says he has. You ought to go just so you can say you've been. Sometimes when I go to Jawbone Canyon, it's been a long time since I was out there, but sometimes when I go, I think of this dry and thirsty land. I think of the wilderness area of Judea. Because if you've never been to Jawbone Canyon, I'll just tell you, you can get out there, and one of the things that you'll find remarkable, especially living in any city, is you go out there and it's quiet. It's really quiet. And there's just a whole lot of what you might call nothing out there. And when I drive out through the desert, you ever raise the question, what would you do if you were responsible like Moses for 2 to 3 million people out in a place like that? What would you do for them? How would you provide for them? Well, if you was out there by yourself, it'd be a difficult task. How would you provide for you in a dry and thirsty land, place that's barren? Now, those are some things I believe that need to fit into this context. They do. They fit into this context. And so David said, when I was there, my soul thirsted for you. Now, look at verse 2. He said, so have I looked upon thee in the sanctuary, and see thy power and thy glory. Because thy loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise thee. So will I bless thee while I live. I will lift up my hands in thy name. My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise thee
with joyful lips. When I remember thee upon my bed and meditate on thee in the night watches. For thou hast been my help, and in the shadow of thy wings will I rejoice. My soul followeth hard after thee. Thy right hand upholdeth me. But those that seek my soul to destroy it shall go into the lower part of the earth. They shall be given over to the power of the sword. They shall be a portion for the foxes. But the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone that sweareth by him shall glory. For the mouth of them that speak lies shall be stopped. I'd let that think on that for a little bit. Here's David, and he's got enemies. He's had to flee. He's in a barren place for his own safety. And he said, when I reflect upon my God, I'm going to seek him. I'm going to seek him as the water, as it were, of life. And I'll be satisfied. Well, now why? People trying to kill him. But when I think about God, I've got to be happy about that. Why? You'll notice he said, you're my help. There's no place else to turn. Been there, done that? Really, have you? And then he said, those that seek my soul to destroy it, they will be destroyed. Case in point, King Saul. When King Saul was trying to kill David, David had opportunity to kill King Saul, but he would not kill God's anointed. But what happened to King Saul? Pardon me? Well, his sons died in battle, but King Saul committed suicide. He fell on his own sword. He was destroyed. Now, what about Absalom? He died in battle. Yeah. His hair got caught in a tree and Joab threw darts at him, killed him. All right. So here's what we are seeing in this passage. How do you respond as one who belongs to the Lord, God's people? How do you respond when you see who God is and then you reflect upon what your problems are? How do you respond to that? See, that's dealt with in the Psalm. Does that make them beneficial to us? We learn how to respond to who God is and to what God has said. Now, I don't know. Maybe I'm not very exciting when I talk about these. But I know that sometimes a particular study is perhaps an academic one. But I hope to stimulate your emotions to feel what David felt, to the extent that you're willing to commit what he committed in many of these psalms. While we're thinking on these things, let me throw something else at you. In verse 6, he said, when I remember thee upon my bed and meditate on thee in the night watches. That's just an interesting statement. When do your thoughts, if you've got a problem, when do they begin to trouble you the most? Nighttime, when you lay down and try to go sleep. Got things on your mind, don't you? Troublesome thoughts. What if somebody's trying to kill you? What if you've had to flee from home? What if you're living out in a place like Jawbone Canyon? You don't have anything. And in the night, you're thinking about all of that. And then in verse 6, I meditate on thee in the night watches. Now, it's obvious just from reading this psalm, just abbreviated reading, so to speak, that David's troubled. He's got problems. A lot worse many times than whatever we've got. But when he pillowed his head at night, maybe on a rock, who knows, I don't know. But he's pillowing his head to try to go to sleep. And rather than to focus only on his problems, he sees God. And brethren, I want to make this point drive home.
because it's going to be consistent throughout the Psalms. We have problems. So did the psalmist, as they wrote many different psalms. Did they talk about their problems? Yes. Is that all they could talk about? I believe, brethren, that a study of the Psalms will help us in this regard. When we have problems, not to let that be all we see. Now, is that helpful? That can't be all that we see, because David saw the greatness of God. David cast his cares upon God, as Peter suggests that we must, commands, 1 Peter 5, verses 5 and 6. Now, having said that, he said, my soul will be satisfied, and my mouth will praise you. Because of who you are. Why? Because you've been my help. You're the shadow, or the shadow of thy wings. I will rejoice. And so I will follow hard after you. That idea of following hard is kind of like the relationship between a husband and a wife. Leave and cleave. It's what David said I'm going to do. I made a decision. I'm going to stay with it. I'm going to follow God. That's the long of it. Yes.
My soul clings.
Clings, that's right. Stick like glue is the thought. So yes, that's good. Now, regarding those who were his enemies, we've mentioned Saul and we've mentioned Absalom. There's a point that is in verse 10 that I want to come back to, the latter part. They shall be a portion for foxes. Now, if you're reading from the New American Standard Translation, it might use the term jackals. No. It's footnoted in the American Standard, jackals. How's it read in the New American Standard?
Verse 10, they will deliver it over to the power of the sword. They will be a prey for foxes.
All right, it uses foxes. All right. Well, some believe that it's talking about either wild dogs or foxes or jackals. And I think the thought is clearly seen when you think about old wicked Jezebel. You remember Richard when they flung her off the wall, 70 times 7, took up 12 baskets full of fragments. That's the humorous side part of it. But we know that they did fling her down off the wall. And the prophecy was that she would be eaten by the dogs. And from what I understand, the jackals and wild dogs did just that. They ate her body. All that was left was, a piece of skull and a hand. And the rest of it was carried off by the wild dogs. So here are enemies of God's people. And here's what happened to them. All right. Well, any questions or comments just here? We could go on and on looking at Psalm 107 and some of these others that we have on the board. In fact, I might want to do that just briefly. Psalm 107 and look at verse 43. Psalm 107, verse 43. Underscored that. I don't want to miss it. Psalm 107. You'll notice that primarily it is a song of thanksgiving. Jehovah delivers men from manifold troubles. Look at verse 1. Oh, give thanks unto Jehovah, for he is good, for the loving kindness endureth forever. But drop down, if you will, to verse 6. Then they cried unto Jehovah in their trouble, and he delivered them out of their distresses. Verses 8 and 9 expresses essentially the same or a very similar thought. But if you'll drop down to the conclusion, one other thing before we do that. Look at verse 23 through 28. 23 through 28. They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters, these see the works of Jehovah and his wonders in the deep. For he commandeth and raiseth the stormy wind, which lifteth up the waves thereof. They mount up to the heavens, they go down again to the deeps. Their soul melteth away because of trouble. They reel to and fro and stagger like a drunk man, and are at their wit's end. Picture that. Here are some that are merchants in the ships, and they're being tossed to and fro, to and fro. They think that they're about to perish. They're at their wit's end. Then they cry unto Jehovah in their trouble. And what does he do? He brings them out of their distress. Now, to get to the point that I was wanting to make, if you'll drop down to verse 43. He said, "Whoso is wise will give heed to these things, and they will consider the loving kindness of Jehovah." Now, as you read this whole chapter, you see it is essentially a psalm of praise and thanksgiving, but the question has to be asked, why? Thanksgiving and praise for what? Well, what's the lesson of it, Randy?
Well, I would say answered prayer.
Answered prayer, yeah. God blesses us. And so praise Him because of the great things that He does. In verse 33, He turneth rivers into a wilderness and water springs into a thirsty ground, you see. He provides. Now, the fellow that's wise, he's going to give heed to these things, and he'll consider and be thankful for the loving kindness of God. Well, enough on that. We could look at 145 as well and talk some more about this same thing, which we will probably do as we go along a little bit. But when we study the Psalms, we see the beauty of the world. God has created this world, and He's made it beautiful for a reason. In fact, as you'll note in Genesis chapter 1, regarding the creation scene itself, we see the work of the Spirit of God in creation. Now, call your attention to that. In Genesis chapter 1, look, if you would please, at verse 2. It says, "The earth was waste and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." Normally, when we're studying from the Genesis account, we like to note that God created the heavens and the earth. And so many times in our thoughts, we think, well, that we're talking about God the Father. He created the heavens and the earth. But then as we turn to such passages as John 1, verses 1, 2, and 3, we see the role of Jesus in creation. He was present there. And then as we read in Colossians chapter 1, beginning about verse 16 or so, we learn that without Him was not anything made, that He created all things that there are. Colossians 1, verse 18, I think I just quoted from John 1. But in Colossians 1, verse 18, let me just read it, lest I get it wrong. It tells us, verse 17, "And He is before all things, and in Him all things consist." Verse 16, "For in Him were all things created, in the heavens and upon the earth, things visible, things invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things have been created through Him and unto Him." That tells us the role of Jesus, the Son, in creation. And what we want to learn here is the Spirit moved upon the face of the deep. What did the Spirit do? Well, if you'll look at Job chapter 26 and verse 13, the text tells us that the Holy Spirit garnished the heavens. He garnished the heavens. What's that mean? Well, let me ask you another question.
What did you say? Job 26.
Job 26, 13. The Spirit garnished the heavens.
In the John 1?
1 through 3, yes. And Colossians 1 was 16 through 18.
New American Standard says, "By His breath the heavens are cleared, His hand has pierced the flaming serpent."
Job 26:13?
Yeah.
Maybe I've got the wrong passage. No, it says, "By His Spirit the heavens are garnished, His hand hath pierced the swift serpent." Job 26:13.
In the New American Standard, there's a marginal reference next to the word "cleared." By His breath, the heavens are cleared. It says, "made beautiful."
All right, that's what I'm looking for. They're made beautiful. I have a footnote that right beside the word "garnished" that means "make beautiful." So what did the Spirit do? You ever garnish a plate? You ever go to a restaurant where somebody puts something on there that you're not supposed to eat? And so what do you do with that? You throw it away, but why is it there if I'm not going to eat it?
It helps refresh the mouth, so you know.
Okay, I'm sure that's why the fellow put it on there. He wanted me to get rid of bad breath.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now tell me why it's there.
To make the plate beautiful.
Makes it pretty. Makes the plate look pretty. All right. What did the Spirit do in creation?
Pretty things up.
Pretty things up. Yeah. Make it pretty. Now, isn't that something? And we've got a point here. When you read in the Psalms, you see that declared. It's beautiful. In Psalms 48, for example. Turn back over to the Psalms once again. Psalms 48. Great is Jehovah, and greatly to be praised. In the city of our God, in His holy mountain. Beautiful in elevation. And joy of the whole earth. The joy of the whole earth. Here's Mount Zion on the sides of the north. The city of the great king. God hath made himself known in her palaces for a refuge. I'd encourage you simply to read the chapter. Verse 12, walk about Zion and go about her. Number the towers there. What's he talking about Zion for? What's the heading? A psalm of the sons of Korah. But what's chapter 48 describing? The beauty and glory of Zion. That's right. The beauty and glory of Zion. It's closely linked with Psalms 46 and 47, as you'll see similar thoughts. But the point that's being presented is God is to be greatly praised because look at what He's done. How beautiful it is. Now that's just a summarization of that in short order. And you can read that psalm in its entirety, as we likely are to do down the pike. Psalm 69, 9 through 13. These others that are on the board express simply essentially the same thing, that these things are set to suggest the majesty of God. Now, having said that, we've noted that there are 116 direct quotations from the Psalms in the New Testament. We've noted as we've tried to catalog the Psalms that many of them are messianic in nature. Now among these 116 direct quotations in the New Testament, you'll notice that there are a lot of them that talk about the Son of God. Now that's not by accident. Look, if you will, at Psalms 2. We were there a couple of weeks ago and noted this, I believe. But I want you to see it on this chart. In Psalms 2, verse 7, it says, I will tell of the degree Jehovah saith unto me, Thou art my Son, this day have I begotten thee. Well, indeed, you read that in Matthew chapter 3 and in verse 17. Thou art my Son. You remember that the Father said that from the cloud when Jesus was being baptized. Thou art my Son. This is my Son. You'll notice also that it is quoted in Acts chapter 13, verse 33. It's also quoted in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 5, in chapter 5, verse 5 of the book of Hebrews. So here is a quotation from this Old Testament psalm. Thou art my Son. This day have I begotten thee. Now the Psalms, as we've noted, were written hundreds, up to 1,000 years before Christ. But yet we find this direct quotation. Turn, if you will, to Psalm chapter 8. Psalm 8, and look at verse 2. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou established strength, because of thine adversaries, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger. Now, if you'll turn over into your New Testament, to Matthew chapter 21, Psalm chapter 8, verse 2. That's not sounding. Yes, it is. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings thou hast established strength. So, in Matthew chapter 21, when Jesus came into the city of Jerusalem, what took place? This is triumphant entry. What happened? Well, look at it. Matthew 21, as he came into the city of Jerusalem, beginning in verse 15.
With palm branches in front of him and shouted.
Like he was going to be their king.
Right.
Yes. And then in verse 16.
Verse 16, he said to him, do you hear what these little children are saying? And Jesus said to them, yes. Have you never read out of the mouth of infants and nursing babes, you have prepared praise for yourself?
Where did that come from? Psalms 8. Have you not read that? That'd make a good sermon, Richard, if you ever had the opportunity. Have ye not read? That statement's made a number of times in the New Testament. Have you not read? And here's an allusion, not an allusion, a direct quotation to this Old Testament psalm. In verse 8 of Psalms, verse 6, Psalm 8, I'll get it in a minute. Thou makest him to leave dominion over the works of their hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. Does that sound familiar? Put all things under his feet. You'll read that in Hebrews 2, verse 8. Again, a direct quotation. He would be raised from the dead. And here's one I think that you'll be more than slightly familiar with. Look at Psalm 16. Psalm 16, verse 10. Psalm 16, verse 10. For thou wilt not leave my soul to Sheol, neither wilt thou suffer thy Holy One to see corruption. Psalm of David. Where is it quoted? Well, it's quoted in Acts 2. The Apostle Peter said it's fulfilled in Jesus of Nazareth, whom you crucified. David was talking about, not David, but he was talking about the Christ, how that he would die and be raised from the dead. Randy, you've commented a number of times in preparation to partake of the Lord's Supper from Matthew 27 and Psalms 22. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? And here's an indication of what took place. Now, I know that there are those who take the position that there was in no sense that Jesus was forsaken on the cross. I don't believe that. Yes, I know that God didn't leave him. But where was Jesus? He was on the cross when he said that. And Randy, as you pointed out so eloquently in the reference to the Lord's Supper, you read that Psalm 22 in its entirety, and you see the picture of the cross. That's what you see. Jesus is not just uttering words, and I'll use this in quotations, because it was in the script. There was a very real sense in which God could not accomplish His will, and Jesus come down from that cross. Couldn't do that. You remember when Jesus was in the garden, He called upon the Father to take this cup from me, if it be thy will. Well, did He? Did He take this cup from Him? No. Jesus said, if I must drink of it, then thy will be done. And so He did. And you read in Hebrews chapter 10 that this is the very reason He came into the world. A body didst thou prepare for me, that He might do what with it? That He might offer it as a sacrifice.
I was just going to say, He wasn't just reading from a script. He wrote the script. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 11, talking about the prophets, seeking to know what person or time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating as He predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. The Spirit of Christ was the one that was telling the prophets what to write.
Yes. Speaking of the suffering that would not be removed, could not be removed, and accomplish redemption. And so we see combined two things, the deity of Jesus as well as the humanity of Jesus. There was nothing exciting or looking forward to such an awful, agonizing death any more than you would. But He knew there was no other way to accomplish man's redemption. So if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Was God with Him? Well, in a very real sense, yes. He didn't just desert Him. But from a humanity standpoint, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? He could not bring His Son down off of that cross. Did Jesus have the power and the authority as the thieves cast in his face? If you're the Son of God, then save yourself. Save us too. Could Jesus do that? Oh yeah. But not and accomplish the will of the Father. So He died. So we see the relevance of Psalms 22 quoted in these New Testament passages. You'll note that He was derided by His enemies, also in Psalms 22. They're beginning in verse 17. No, verse 7 it is. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, commit thyself unto Jehovah. Let Him deliver him. Let Him rescue him, seeing he delighteth in him. Well, you read that in Luke's account in chapter 23 and verse 35. The very thing they said. Yes, Randy?
I know we're about out of time, but that in Psalm 22, I think the one that really brings the point home is verse 16. The dogs have surrounded me, a band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. That can't be about David. But that never happened to David.
No, it did not.
So that has to be a prophecy.
It is. It is indeed fulfilled in the New Testament. Now, next time, we're going to finish this series of charts comparing what was said in the Psalms to specifically what was said about Jesus. Specific quotations. It'll be another study when we talk about the Messianic Psalms, because they speak concerning things that would occur, although not specific quotations in the New Testament. But these are specific quotations in the New Testament from the Psalms. So we'll look at some more of those. And then I want to look at Psalms 1. And then we're going to, if you're on our website at all, you'll notice the material by Gene Taylor. We're going to be looking at some of that and cataloging some of these Psalms somewhat for an outline of our study. So we'll be studying more detail, verse-by-verse kind of study from some specific Psalms as we progress. All right, that's it for now.